Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm Erin McKeown, in for John Schaefer. Before we get started today, I want to take you back, way back, all the way back to January of this year. You can't keep us out, you can't keep us out, you can't keep us out, you can't keep us out. Try to stop a war, try to stop a fire, try to stop a culture. Does that voice sound familiar? Yep, that's me. Erin McKeown, singer, songwriter, and producer, performing on this very show 6 months ago. Man, so much has changed since January 2013. Another season of Mad Men has come and gone. The Ravens won the Super Bowl, as I correctly predicted on this show. Kim and Kanye named their new baby Northwest, which no one could have predicted. And, almost simultaneously, I started blogging about sports for soundcheck.org and writing a musical. Later, we're going to look at the combination of those two things, sports and musicals, and sports and opera, and sports and drama. We'll talk with a composer, a director, and a critic about the role of sports on stage. But first, as I sit here on the other side of the mic, let's hear someone else play in the Soundcheck studio. Most people would call Cecile McLaurin-Salvant a jazz vocalist, but she doesn't just sing, she plays with her music. Her new album is called Woman Child, and it's a surprising collection of 20th century standards, hidden gems, and some of her own compositions. Cecile McLaurin-Salvant is here today in the studio with her band. They're going to start things off with a song, Nobody, live on Soundcheck.
When life seems full of clouds and rain, and I am filled with naught but pain, who soothes my thumping, bumping brain? Nobody. When summer comes all cool and clear, and my friends see me drawing near, who says, hey friend, let's have a beer?
Nobody.
I ain't never done nothing to know. From nobody, no time. And until I get something from somebody, I will never do nothing for nobody, no time. When I was in that railroad and thought I'd cashed in my last check, who took the engine off my neck? Who? Nobody. When winter comes with snow and sleet, and me with hunger and cold feet, who says, here's 25 cents, go on, get something to eat?
Nobody.
I ain't nothing from nobody, no time. And until I get something from somebody, I will never do nothing for nobody, no
singer Cecile McLaurin-Salvant with Aaron Deal on piano, Paul Sakivi on bass, and Lawrence Leathers on drums. I'm Erin McKeown in for John Schaefer. I'm talking with jazz vocalist Cecile McLaurin-Salvant today. Her new album is called Woman Child. Cecile, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you.
I'm so glad that you started with Nobody. It's actually one of my favorite songs. And it's such a, it operates on so many levels. It's such a sad song. It's such a clever song. And in my view, it's such a political song. For those who aren't familiar, it was originated by Burt Williams, black performer in 1913, first black man to appear on Broadway, a comedian, known as a comedian. What are you thinking as you move through a lyric like that?
Well, first time I heard it, I was really stunned because he was, like you said, he was both... very, very funny, but also it was extremely sad to me. And he was kind of talking over the music for the on the first part of the song, and I thought that was really fascinating. And so it really inspired me to try my go at juggling those two things in one song, which it's not always easy because sometimes you wanna go more towards like the humorous aspect of it, but. But it's definitely a song that it's one of my favorite Burt Williams songs, and I think it's pretty complex. And when you read about his story and his life, it's pretty incredible. I mean, he used to wear blackface, and he was black, and so he would play the stereotypical black man for white audiences, and he was extremely successful, but also very depressed because he was basically clowning and also suffering because it was a very difficult time.
And it's certainly a unique choice for you on your record, and that seems to be something that you do in general is, you know, I've read that you are trying to pick less known, less recorded songs from, you know, earlier parts of the century and bring something to them. Besides that maybe something hasn't been given as much treatment as other things, what are you looking for in these songs that you're picking?
Well, usually when I choose a song, it's mostly because of the lyric and the story of the song, I guess. And if there's kind of, I guess, an edge to the story, it could be interpreted in several ways. Or... you know, maybe kind of an ironic twist to it or something. And I'll just sort of write down whatever songs I hear that I think have that sort of strangeness to them. And I love to sing those songs, you know. I think it's a lot more fun for me to deal with something that maybe is a little bit weird in a way.
Well, I want to ask you how you found this next song you're going to play for us, if this isn't Love from the show Finian's Rainbow.
Well,
how?
Actually, this is a song that I did not find. When I was living in France, I was working with a band with two guitarists who also sang and a bass player who also sang, actually. We did a lot of stuff with several voices. And he found this song, and I thought it was really, really cool. I think he heard a version by Sarah Vaughan and another one by Cannonball Adderley.
Now, you were in France because you were going to university?
Sort of. It started off that way. I went to university after high school in France, but I quickly started going to the conservatory and studying classical voice and jazz and Baroque voice. And that definitely became the main focus.
Can you tell me what Baroque voice is?
Well, it's it's kind of like classical voice. I guess it is considered classical voice, but it's the technique that was used for early music, or that we think was used for early music. So from 16th to 17th and early 18th century, with, you know, the early instruments like the lute and the harpsichord and all sorts of crazy stuff.
Well, let's hear whether you bring Baroque or not to it. Let's hear if this isn't love.
A secret, I've got a little secret. A secret kind of secret. I'm aching for to shout it to every daffodil and tell the world about it. In fact, I think I will.
If this isn't love, the whole world is crazy.
If this isn't love, I am daft as a daisy. With moons all around and cows jumping over, I'm busting with bliss and I'll eat my hat if it isn't love. I'm
My guest is Cecile McLaurin-Salvant, with Aaron Deal on piano, Paul Sakivi on bass, and Lawrence Leathers on drums. Well, that song is certainly not an early music tempo, and certainly not a Baroque arrangement.
No.
It also contains my favorite new line of a song that I've heard lately, My Heart Needs a Plumber.
Oh.
Hello. that's so excellent. I want to talk about your collaboration with your pianist, Aaron. It's clear that you guys have something that's building with each other, that what he brings to your music is really important. How did you meet? What drew you guys to each other?
We were introduced by my manager, actually. I was looking for someone to work with, a piano player to work with, in New York for a couple gigs that I had lined up, and I didn't really know anyone, and I was kind of new to the whole scene or whatever it is. And so my manager sent me this list of pianists. So I went on YouTube and I was like looking up everyone, and I saw a video of Aaron playing Viper's Drag, and I was like, what? So immediately I was like, oh, I really want to work with him and try to see if we can collaborate together.
I mean, as a singer, you have a bunch of options of people you can collaborate with, different types of instruments, right? Do you play an instrument?
Ish, sort of, kind of.
Ish, what's ish? What?
Piano-ish.
Piano-ish, okay. You know, so you could be collaborating with a drummer, you could be collaborating closely with a bass player, with a horn player. What is it that collaborating with a pianist, do you think, brings to what you're doing here?
Oddly enough, it's probably the instrument that I'm the most, well, since I play the piano, it's probably the instrument that I'm the most, yeah, that I'm the most familiar with, I guess. And I really know, like, beyond any other instrument, what I look for in someone playing the piano or someone playing with me or something. So it's easier for me, I guess, to sort of start the process with the piano. I mean, that's how I work at home on music too. So it seems like a natural leaning.
Next you're going to play for us, I Didn't Know What Time It Was, Rodgers and Hart song. And
yeah.
I've been really struck by, in particular, I mean, all the arrangements that you have are really fascinating to me, but I was struck in particular with this particular arrangement. And before you play it, I was just wondering if you could maybe tell me, like, was this always the idea for the arrangement for it? Did it evolve? Like, where did it come from? Because it's really quite unique.
Well, I do want to say we're actually pretty lucky, because this is like the original band that came up with the arrangement that's playing today. I just brought in the song, and then I don't remember who sort of set up that motif, but
there's some finger pointing here.
Was it Aaron Deal?
In the studio.
So it was Aaron Deal. And then they just started doing their thing. Paul and Lawrence, we were in Aaron's apartment up in Harlem.
Well, let's hear it. Cecile McLaurin-Salvant, I Didn't Know What Time It Was.
Didn't know what time it was, then I met you. Oh, what a lovely time it was, how sublime it was too. I didn't know what day it was you held my hand. Warm like the month of May it was, and I'll say it was grand, grand to be alive, to be young, to be mad, to be yours alone. Grand to see your face, feel your touch, hear your voice say I'm all your own. I didn't know what year it was, life was no prize. wanted love, and there it was, shining out of your eyes. I'm wise, and I know what time it is now.
Say I'm all of your own. I didn't know what year it was. Life was no prize. I wanted love, and there it was, shining out of your eyes. I'm wise, and I know.
I'm Erin McKeown, in for John Schaefer. That's my guest, Cecile McLaurin-Salvant, singing. Erin Deal on the piano, Paul Sakivi on bass, Lawrence Leathers on drums. They will be back in New York City to perform on August 24th at the Charlie Parker Festival in Harlem's Marcus Garvey Park. Cecile McLaurin-Salvant, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Le front caché sur tes genoux. J'ai sangloté toute ma peine. Il faisait sombre autour de nous et le soir sentait la verveine. Le front caché sur tes genoux. J'ai sangloté toute ma peine. Il faisait sombre autour de nous et le soir sentait la verveine. Mon cœur battait à triste coups, comprenant sa tendresse vaine. Le front caché sur tes genoux, j'ai sangloté toute ma peine.
Coming up, what happens when the worlds of sports and music collide? We'll hear about two, yes, two new operas about boxers and a musical version of the first Rocky film that's coming to Broadway. I'm Erin McKeown, in for John Schaefer. That's next on Soundcheck.
I like the way they dribble up and down the court, just like I'm the king on the microphone. So it's Dr. J and Moses Malone. I like slam dunks and taking it to the hoop. My favorite play is the alley oop. I like the pick and roll, I like the give and go, cause it's basketball of Mr. Curtis Blow.
This is Soundcheck. I'm Erin McKeown. At first glance, sports and theater might seem to be incompatible. Take the NBA, for example. A player can actually be penalized for theatrics. Pretend to get fouled on a play? That could cost you $5,000. You won't be fined for bringing sports into a theater, but that doesn't mean it's easy to turn big games and big athletes into stage dramas, musicals, or operas. Later in the show, we'll talk to a director and a composer, each of whom has helped to bring the life of a sports hero to the stage. But first, I'm joined by David Cody, theater editor of Time Out New York. Welcome, David.
Thanks, Erin.
Well, there is a lot of sports-related stuff on stage. Let's start here. Does sports make for good raw material for theater?
I do think it does, because it's sort of an exotic world that theater folk might not necessarily know that much about. I don't want to make any judgments, of course. I mean, there's plenty of people who love baseball and Stephen Sondheim probably, but I think that when you bring the sports into the theater, it's like, what is this world? I mean, it's very visual. I mean, there's a lot of kinetic movement. There's a lot of costuming and movement, and so I think it inherently works on stage as a spectacle. And of course, I think theater people or theater audiences are interested in the stories behind drama, behind sports. That is, who are these players, and what are they driven by, and what are the rivalries or the sort of private demons that drive them? I mean, the sports is of course has tons of scandal and drama. If you look at it, I mean, you have fixing of games, you have doping, you have injuries, or sometimes even death in the sports. So there's plenty of material there, I think.
Well, for those who don't know or want to know more, what's out there right now?
Well, right now there is a what's coming down the pike for Broadway in spring of 2014 is Rocky, the iconic boxing Sylvester Stallone
really?
Movie. Yes, that's being turned into a musical. Actually, it was done out of town, way out of town in Germany. Director Alex Timbers and an American cast and crew put it on, and it's basically a musical retelling of the great story of Rocky Balboa and his fight to the top. Or actually, not to the top necessarily, but for those who know the movie.
Here it's chaos. Rocky, you went the distance. You went the 15 rounds. How do you feel?
All right.
What are you thinking about when that buzzer sounds? What are you thinking about when the 15th round when you're coming out?
Rocky. Is Sylvester Stallone involved? I'm sure that everyone wants to know that.
Yeah, I think he's a producer on it. And it was his idea, and he sort of got the whole ball rolling.
The fight was not the most important part. The part was the heart. It's a story that can go on from generation to generation about how everyone is entitled to a moment of dignity.
Fight from the heart.
So that's Rocky coming to Broadway next year.
I think that the director, Alex Timbers, is one of the most exciting young directors around right now. He did a show called Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson a few years back. He's got a show at the Public right now called Here Lies Love, which is with music by David Byrne about Imelda Marcos. He's a director who can handle impossible musicals, like impossible to stage. Like, how do you stage a boxing match without killing your actors every week? And I was talking to him about it recently, and he was saying that he and choreographer Stephen Hoggett have come up with a full contact choreography for the fights, meaning that they actually the actors actually make contact, but they're not hitting each other, if that makes any sense. So it's highly coordinated, it's highly safe, I guess, but it's realistic, because there's a big coup de théâtre at the end of the show.
Yeah, I read about this. I was actually wondering if you knew what it was.
Well, they invite some of the audience onto the stage.
Supposed to, don't spoil it.
Amazing. I'm sorry. Well, you'll forget by the time it comes. But basically, they want the audience to be up. Because the interesting thing, I mean, not to go off on too much of a tangent, but the interesting thing about theater versus film in terms of depicting sports In film, you have special effects and amazing camera angles that make you feel like you're in the game. Whereas theater, you are. It's more like a sports event because you're watching it as in an arena. So I think with Rocky, I think they're going to try to get the sense that you are there in the boxing ring watching a real fight happening. So to get that sort of rush.
Right, you have to be right up close to be able to get it.
Right, so it looks realistic, yeah.
There's another boxing production right now from Opera Theater of St. Louis. It's called Champion. What is that about?
Champion is a new opera by Terrence Blanchard and librettist Michael Christopher about boxer Emile Griffith, who happened to be gay and who, of course, found a conflict between the approval of him beating somebody to a bloody pulp in a ring and, you know, actually being gay with another man. So it's that sort of dichotomy in his life and his career.
What makes a man a man? What makes a man the man he is? Is it the flesh and bone inside? The skin he wears, the color of his voice, the walk he walks, the talk he talks inside.
The idea of homosexuality in the sports, which of course is still very, you know, fodder for news stories. Way back in like 2002, playwright Richard Greenberg did a play called Take Me Out, which was a wonderful baseball drama that was kind of ahead of its time because you had a superstar player on a fictitious team who came out of the closet just suddenly. And it threw the team dynamics into disarray. And, of course, they had all these scenes in the shower and the guys very nervously in the shower with each other. So it was a terrific play that sort of – It was about being gay. It was about being on a team. It was about sports in America. It was a really ambitious and wonderful play, and ahead of its time. You know, it was long before that basketball player came out. Its name I'm forgetting right now.
Jason Collins.
Because I am a theater geek and not a sports person. Thank you.
Yes, I do want to know, why is it always about the showers, right? Why is it always, when you're talking about sports, why is it people always concerned about the showers? This is Soundcheck. I'm Erin McKeown, in for John Schaefer. We're talking with David Cody, theater critic for Time Out New York, about musicals, plays, and operas that have been inspired by the world of sports. Certainly baseball has a history on stage, several important productions. Baseball, Take Me Out, as you were saying, and of course Damn Yankees is the one that everyone thinks of first. We have a clip here of Golden Boy, which was first a play in 1937, and then a musical in 1964, starring Sammy Davis Jr. Let's listen to a clip of Sammy Davis Jr.
Summer, not a bit of breeze. Neon signs are shining through the tired trees. Lovers walking to and fro. Everyone has someone and a place to go. Listen, hear the cars go past. They don't even see me flying by so fast. They are moving, going who knows where. Only thing I know is I'm not going there.
That was Sammy Davis Jr. singing Night Song from the musical Golden Boy, boxing musical we've been talking about with my guest David Cody. I'm Erin McKeown, in today for John Schaefer. It seems to me, you know, we're talking about these recent productions, you know, certainly 20th century and forward, but it certainly seems to me that this is not a new connection at all. Like, how far back does the connection between sports and theater go?
Well, I mean, the rivalry between sports and theater goes back. I mean, if you want me to go way back.
Go way back.
The way back machine. Ancient Greece, of course, had its City Dionysia Festival, which is a big festival to award the top drama to a top award to a tragedy. And of course, they had that, and they had the Olympics. I mean, any advance to society, whatever that means, has a balance between sports and athletic and art. But of course, in Elizabethan England, in Shakespeare's time, his greatest competition, besides from other theaters, was from bear baiting, which I don't think anyone in in modern society we call it a sport, but it's a blood sport. Basically, the bear garden or the Paris Garden was also on the south bank of the Thames, where the globe was, not in the same area. But anyway, so the bear baiting is, well, it's you take a bear and you sort of chain it to the center of a ring, and then you set some dogs on it. And occasionally for extra fun, you tie a monkey to its head. And the Elizabethans loved this. So it was either like, oh, do I go see Julius Caesar or do I go see, the bear get torn apart by dogs? It was a culture of contradictions, you could say.
How do you compete with something like that?
Well, maybe it was the same as it is today. Somebody's like, oh, you're going to the theater? Oh man, I'm going to the bear baiting. Come on, I don't want to see Shakespeare. I don't know. It was just maybe people enjoyed both. It was definitely. I think Shakespeare definitely had to make sure up his game to make sure that he could provide more excitement than animals tearing each other apart.
Well, I guess that makes me think of it's a great analog, right? Is that here we are today? We're competing so much with people's attention. There's a whole lot of things to do besides going to the theater for your time, and so I'm wondering if there's something, are Broadway producers thinking this way now about ways to get people in the theater? Like, we have to do something so spectacular that it's going to compete with the 200 other things you could do without even leaving your sofa.
I think that's absolutely true, because we live in a sort of 3D HD culture now where the experience has to be more intense, more in the theater, more interactive. I mean, of course, you have the long-running show Sleep No More, which is just this incredible sort of immersive experience. And you have, like I said before, Here Lies Love, which is an environmental production, a show called Murder Ballad at the Union Square Theater, also sort of environmental. So you've got these shows that are just like trying to make the theatrical experience more vivid and in your face and exciting and involving.
And you have Once, where you have people go on stage before the show and in the middle and buy their beer from the pub that you're looking at.
Yeah, so in that sense, I mean, it's historically people. It's a fascinating difference between the visceral and the sort of poetic. I mean, if you really want to get your if you really need to have an intense, real, visceral experience, and you go to the sports. I mean, I'm not saying it's either or, but you see people actually jumping, running, sweating, falling, maybe breaking something, and so it's a real physical experience. Whereas in theater, even though there's a lot of, especially in a musical, there's a lot of effort and muscularity involved, it's also a language of metaphor and poetry, So it's like we don't actually put it on stage. We sort of evoke it through song or language. So it's like literalism versus metaphor, if you want to, look at it that way.
Yeah, or look at audience targets, I suppose. And I would hate to gender it, but I do wonder if some of this is about trying to bring, I think it's something like 2/3 of the Broadway audience are women. So is this part of this to try to bring men to the theater?
Yeah, I think definitely there's that attempt. I mean, and if maybe the idea is that if you have a married couple, if the man wants to go, the woman will come along. So it's like it's a 2-for-1. Whereas, I mean, again, to be gendered and cliche about it, if a woman wants to go see a play or a musical, she might have to drag her husband along. So whereas I don't know if most women are interested in sports. I mean, I don't know what the number. I mean, you say 2/3, and that's very true. That the majority audience is, for theater is for women. But I wonder what it's like in sports. What the numbers are in terms of that.
I think it's probably more women than are given it credit for. Is probably true. But let's go back to Rocky and let's wrap up here. Are you going to go see it?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I love an underdog story, and I haven't heard much of the score, so I don't know how that'll pan out, but. I'm really the idea that there's the director is going to try to get out of the sort of proscenium limitations of most Broadway houses. All these theaters on Broadway are like 100 years old and they're very set. The fact that he's going to try to mix it up and sort of bring us on stage or make it more interactive, I think is great, because Broadway needs to move on. It needs to move on to different spaces and different ways of presentation. So, and I mean, I love sports in the theater. I can't sit down and watch a game because, life's too short. But, I love sports in the theater.
David Cody is the theater editor at Time Out New York. David, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, we'll talk to members of the creative teams behind a boxing opera and a basketball drama. I'm Erin McKeown, and today for John Schaefer, this is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm Erin McKeown, musician, producer, and yes, occasional sports blogger for soundcheck.org. We were just talking with the critic David Cody about the relationship between sports and theater. My next two guests have some very direct experience in that area. Thomas Kail directed two Broadway shows about sports, Lombardi, about Green Bay Packers coach Vince Lombardi, and Magic Bird, about basketball stars Magic Johnson and Larry Bird. He also directed the Tony Award-winning musical In the Heights. Welcome, Thomas.
Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
And joining me on the phone is DJ Spar, who composed the music for the new opera Approaching Ali, about one writer's friendship with boxer Muhammad Ali. Welcome, DJ.
Thank you so much.
You're on the phone from Boulder, Colorado, yes?
Yes.
All right. Thomas, let me start with you. You directed Lombardi and Magic Bird on Broadway, but you've done more than sports. You were nominated for a Tony for directing In the Heights. Is sports and the theater a strange combo, or is there a bigger appetite for it now?
I think there's potentially always been an appetite for it, and just now people are starting to recognize that. The two producers of Lombardi, and who also did Magic Bird, Ferenc Kirmser and Tony Ponturo, basically came up with an idea that I think was something that was very in sync with what I believe, which is stories are everywhere, and where is their inherent drama? And one of the things that David Cody spoke about, I think this idea of the underdog story is prevalent in story, kind of throughout the history of sports. I think there's a reason why we all get obsessed with the Olympics, and it's mostly because of those two-minute packages they roll, where we find out where they're from or what they did or what they overcame, and then we're weeping and we're cheering for a sport we've never heard of. So what I found also was, as someone who came from playing sports, I played soccer and baseball my whole life, is there was an understanding of community that I had that kind of brought me to the theater. So directing and coaching had a lot in common. And then I also started thinking about my own experiences going to see sporting events growing up in the D.C. area and remembering a game and holding on to that ticket in the same way that people hold on to a playbill. I was there that night when this happened. So I think that the idea of a singular experience, if you really make theater really specific and really meaningful and full of energy, it feels like it happened that night for you. And I think that sports, you know, has that as well. And so I think there's a way for people to participate in both and to start to see that overlap.
Right. Ideally, you wouldn't be a sports fan or a theater fan. You'd be a fan of these stories.
Right.
DJ, let me ask you. Are you a sports fan?
Yes. Mostly college football. But I follow many other sports as well.
Are you a boxing fan?
I am a Muhammad Ali fan, and I've started, just in being with this project, getting a little more into boxing, but I wasn't a boxing fan per se.
It sounds like it doesn't necessarily matter, right? If you're a fan of stories, that's what you can bring to it. Therefore, let me ask Thomas, what attracted you specifically to Lombardi and Magic Bird?
Different things. One, I think with Lombardi, that was a chance for me to explore leadership. So if what I do has any sort of correlation to coaching, here was a chance for me to examine what I've given my life to, which is getting a group of people in one place and trying to have them move in one direction and what that means and what it necessitates. It also was a story fundamentally and kind of interestingly that flipped on its head the kid comes to town. Lombardi is about the big city guy who goes out to the middle of nowhere to try to make a life. Lombardi, born in New York, Fordham and all these other things, goes to Green Bay, he said, I don't know where that is on the map, but people are going to know once I leave. And so that idea, which is, you know, the kind of fish out of water, is also a story that we're very familiar with. Magic Bird was a chance for me to really try to humanize the myth. And I think that as someone who grew up in the Jordan era, you know, I was 11 years old when Jordan took off from the foul line in 1988. And so I was a big-time Jordan guy. But I knew where it came from. I knew that the other two people up on the mountain, you know, that kind of carried that torch and really made the NBA were Magic and Larry. And so the question for me was, how do you take people that are so present in our lives and try to tell their story and gather around a campfire in this theater and say, yes, we're in the theater. It's not about mimicry. It's about essence. And so brotherhood and how we define ourselves by another. And whether that's Joker, Batman, I mean, that's all over the place. And these are two men that define themselves in that way. So what do you do when you put the sword down and you're not battling anymore and you have to come back down? Well, you know, those are the stories that I found myself really drawn to.
DJ, what intrigued you about the story of Muhammad Ali?
Well, when I met Davis Miller, who basically came to my house, knocked on my door, and he sublet our house in Richmond. a few years ago, he described the moment that he met Ali as, and which was his idol his whole life, as the air around him being electrified, and that actually, like, meeting his idol lived up to the expectations he had of the idol, whereas, you know, you hear other people say similar things, and the idol doesn't really live up to it. He's just like, oh, he's like a regular person. But what the story of him kind of befriending Ali and this one night that they shared, that was really intriguing to me, and that he had a kind of a left-to-right progression of overcoming his struggle for life. This is Davis Miller. By idolizing Ali and then meeting him, it seemed really attractive for a musical piece.
Right, and we just want to make clear that Davis Miller has written a book about meeting Muhammad Ali, the Tao of Muhammad Ali, and then the opera is based on that story.
Correct.
Thomas was saying something really interesting of thinking about his job as a director as like that of a coach, like a really specific sports metaphor there. Do you feel like as a composer you can think of some equivalent metaphor for what you bring to a production like an opera?
Yeah, I mean, what I do a lot is analyze, but I listen to many interviews of football coaches and how they manage their teams and sort of things they do. And I guess in some ways the composer is sort of like a coach and that you're providing a playbook or something. I guess there's a pretty good parallel there. Like an offensive coordinator would give a playbook to his players, but then, and I give a musical score, and then that's interpreted, and what happens is not, it's reflective of what goes on, but there's a real in-the-moment experience with each thing. But I definitely try very hard, and since I love college football so much, I anything I can do to relate that to my job as a composer is important.
Thomas, I want to go to you now, and I want to ask you about continuing with this sort of process. Once we dig in, you have an actor in front of you, and they may or may not have a history with the character. They may or may not have the same history you have, where you came up with sports and you saw this bigger picture from sports. What do you say to an actor? What do you say, to example, for Dan Lauria, to help him along the way of becoming Vince Lombardi?
Well, Dan Lauria was a special case because Dan Lauria went to college on a football scholarship, and, you know, I didn't have to teach that guy anything about anything.
Gentlemen, this is a football. This season will be the start of something new. And with every fiber of my being, I'm going to make you the best football team that I can make you. And I'll try. And I'll try again. And if I don't succeed the first time, I'll try again. And you have got to give everything that's in you in order to stop that play on defense or to make the play go if you're on offense. Because this may be the one play in the whole ballgame that could cause the winning or the losing of the entire season.
You know, so Dan was someone who came up playing sports and understanding that inherently. Judith Light, the incomparable Judith Light, who played his wife in the show.
I want to say Dan Lauria was on The Wonder Years and Judith Light was on Who's the Boss?
These things are true. These things
just
are true.
To set the stage for,
yes,
people of a certain age.
And, you know, Judith was someone who didn't have a huge exposure to football. You know, she appreciated tennis and other sports. And one of the things that became very clear is that didn't matter. What mattered was finding truth. And so what I knew is that as a sports fan who watches every sports movie that comes out and, you know, tries to see as much theater regarding, you know, that's related to sports, is I know what can pull you out of the story. When the details are wrong, when the specifics are not there, the story's over. Like, I'm checked out. So I said, I'll take care of that. Let's try to get to what's at the core of this. And one of the reasons I think Lombardi was able to find an audience here and is being done all over the country now, sort of regionally, is it was about the pursuit of excellence and the cost of excellence. So that was fundamentally a play about a relationship set in the world of football, told with authenticity. But I think that's where people found their way in, whether they'd, you know, seen a game or not. And we definitely had, you know, dozens and dozens of fans every night, you know, who would come in jerseys, who would come with memorabilia, you know, and saw this as an event. And the NFL was, participated and really kind of helped us create a world, even as you walked into the Circle in the Square Theater, which was in the rounds, and I think a perfect setting for this, that as you came down the escalator, you started to see photos of then. You know, this was about going back in time. Magic and Bird, they're still here and very present. Lombardi is a ghost. It was, in some sense, it was a ghost story, and we were chasing this man who was gone too soon and had been gone for 40 years. So how could we honor that? That was the question more than anything.
This is Soundcheck. I'm Erin McKeown in today for John Schaefer. We're talking about stage plays, musicals, operas inspired by the sports world. My guests are Thomas Kail, who directed the sports dramas Magic Bird and Lombardi on Broadway. He also directed the Tony Award-winning musical In the Heights. And DJ Spar, who composed the music for Approaching Ali, an opera about one writer's friendship with Muhammad Ali. Approaching Ali was recently staged at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. DJ, you know, as Thomas was talking about, Vince Lombardi is gone. He's a ghost. We have this sort of popular culture memory of him right now. Muhammad Ali, though in some ways compromised in a present sense and certainly iconic, is still here with us. What does it mean to be writing music for someone like Muhammad Ali, who is still here?
Yeah, that was actually where most of my creative energy went into. Well, not most, but a fair amount went into how to set Ali, and we talked with Mark Campbell and Davis Miller about the first moment you see Ali when he comes from behind the door is a really big moment for the audience because they need to accept this actor or the singer as Ali because everyone has images of them in their head. A big part of it was that we were portraying Ali in his 40s at the beginning of the opera, and not a lot of people have a memory of that. I think they have the memory of the kind of bombastic young Ali. So we chose a really great actor, Solomon Howard Singer, who is he's a physical specimen. So he fit all the bills for for playing the young Ali. And when Ali approached, I created a music that just sustained, so that sort of time stopped, because Davis Miller, the singer, needed to kind of appreciate that moment and live in it, and I thought the audience did as well. And I didn't worry too much that Ali was alive, because that was pretty much would give you like a huge hang up, because he's a real, you know, like eventually he'll hear this, and you know, his daughters have come to the show and everything. So that I sort of just put out of my mind, and thinking of him as this kind of like Buddha figure that changes someone just by being in their presence was how I approached writing for his character.
I want to ask you both a technical question, almost. How much of actual, for example, in Magic Bird, how much actual basketball is there? And in Approaching Ali, how much actual boxing is there? DJ, you go first.
Sure, yeah. In Approaching Ali, in the story from the book, Davis Miller does some play boxing and with Ali. And in those moments, he saw a flash of Ali. I mean, what you have there is a person in their 40s who all of a sudden is, you know, trained and amazingly, like, his hands are just flying at a million miles a second. And that's when Davis Miller said, oh, my gosh, this guy still has it. And so there's some of that, and then there's some kind of moving around in a sort of almost comical way. And then when there's the reveal that the young Davis Miller, who's played by a boy soprano, sees Ali on television, there's a shadow boxing effect with a scrim and a backlight. And then Solomon Howard did a really great job, and there was a choreographer where the child and Ali sort of mimic each other, even though it's choreographed perfectly. So we didn't have any like boxing ring matches, but we hinted at it a lot, and I used percussion effects to sort of simulate boxing bags and things like that.
Tommy,
you know, for Magic Bird, we did two things. You know, the sort of stylization that DJ's talking about with the scrim, our version of that was there was a moment where Red Auerbach, who had drafted and was really responsible for Larry Bird coming to the Celtics, said, all right, I heard your hands hurt, so prove me wrong. And this is, you know, from a real story. And we had a turntable on stage, and everything dumped out, and it kind of, the light funneled down to Larry, and he went into the position just prior to releasing the ball, and we rotated on a very slow crawl and then just used media to hit 15, 20 shots in a row. But there were other times later in the show where Tug Coker, who played basketball and, you know, AAU and, you know, walked onto his Division I team, said, I can do. So we wanted it to be just enough where you could relax and say, oh, they know what they're doing. You know, like, it's in there. You know, obviously with Lombardi is a slightly different thing. Because he was a coach, it was really about a different kind of intensity. We made sure that, you know, the way that the players handled the ball, all those little things, the details that you appreciate as a sports fan, we hoped were there.
DJ, what's the future of Approaching Ali? We're going to see it in New York soon?
Oh, that would be fabulous. There are other opera companies who have come to see it and are hopefully planning it. And one of the great things about the Approaching Ali and what Mark Campbell and Davis did with the libretto is that it really tells the story of a young person who overcomes a lot of struggles in their life of bullying and loss of a family member and things like that. So there are opportunities for opera companies to use it. It's also a small cast and a small orchestra, so there are opportunities that they can use it for sort of reaching out to other groups that would maybe not usually come to opera, and it can be sort of moved around easier. So there's a future, and there are people talking, but there's nothing official as of right this moment.
Thomas, you've done Lombardi, you've done Magic Bird, two productions got a lot of notice about sports. You're interested in doing it again?
Absolutely. Yeah, the right story is the right story, and if it hits you in your gut and you wake up the next day and feel like you have to tell it, then I'm in.
My guests have been Thomas Kail, director of the sports dramas Magic Bird and Lombardi on Broadway. He also directed the Tony Award-winning musical In the Heights, and DJ Spar, who composed the music for Approaching Ali, an opera about one writer's friendship with Muhammad Ali. Thanks, Thomas. Thanks, DJ.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Join me tomorrow on Soundcheck for a conversation with Mason Curry, the author of a fascinating new book called Daily Rituals: How Artists Work. Plus, Steve Smith of Time Out New York will do his best to make a Black Sabbath fan out of me. And live music from the Hanson family. That's tomorrow. It's been great, everyone. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you back here tomorrow night. I'm Erin McKeown, in for John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck. Soundcheck.